You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, I'm Sue Nelson from the Food Talk Show, and I'm joined as usual by lovely guests. And on the Food Talk Show, we taste amazing food, which is the terrible part of the job. We talk about food technology and food innovation and generally just have a good time. Hi there, Guy, you're my fellow presenter as usual. How
are
you
doing?
Your
right-hand man today, as always. Usually we sit opposite each other. It's nice to be on this side of the table for a change.
That's good, because I don't actually have to look at you this week.
That's my favourite part of the show as
well. Yes, indeed. So today we're joined by Chris Nicholas. Now, Chris is a bit of an expert on social media, and he runs this amazing company called Somewhat Social.
That's a brilliant name.
It is good. S-U-M-W-O-T, Somewhat Social. And he's going to be talking about that. And we're joined again by our favourite... how would I describe you, Ollie? My favourite great British chef aficionado, but also a person who has a finger on the pulse in terms of market research, in terms of food. So you're gonna chip in a bit today, aren't you?
It's good to be back.
Yeah, good to be back.
It's nice to have you back.
Yeah, and very, very exciting because, it's a little bit warm in the studio today.
It is a bit warm. I feel like we need some refreshment.
We need some refreshment, which is pretty handy because we have Hannah Rhodes from Hiver Beers here. So hi, Hannah.
Hello.
And particularly in the second half of the programme, I'm hoping you've got one of your beers in a fridge somewhere.
I do. You're in luck, absolutely.
So we're going to have a little taste of that. Okay. So let's start with Chris. Can you just give me a little bit of background, Chris, on how you actually got into social media in the first place? Because it's so many people are now using it, particularly in the food sector, and it's really taken on a life of its own. So we're going to talk about all the different types of social media in a minute, but how on earth did you manage to... Because nobody sort of leaves university and goes, oh, no, I'll be a social media guru.
Well, maybe when you left, there wasn't even such a thing.
Exactly,
he's
That's a good point, Guy.
I'm not saying he's old,
too. quite old.
It says in my notes that he graduated just before the turn of the millennium.
Exactly, It was dial-up, which was crazy time.
I remember that.
But, it's an interesting question. How did I get into it? I actually, like so many, when the big crash happened, I got made redundant. And I was desperate to try and find myself a new job. So I actually started using LinkedIn. Based on using LinkedIn, people sort of started to approach me saying, could you show us how to get a job using LinkedIn? And that's kind of where it started.
Your job was to show people how to get a job in LinkedIn? Or did you actually
not,
have a
not
proper
for
job?
LinkedIn, but could you get me a job with LinkedIn? I think I'm very, very good. No, it's actually, I just started helping people, showing them how to use LinkedIn. And based on that, I thought, crikey, there's actually a business opportunity here. So I started to help people with that, including sort of businesses and also people who've been made redundant. So actually showing them how to use it. How to sort of sculpt, create their CVs, and how to use LinkedIn to connect with potential new job opportunities.
See, so many people hate LinkedIn. I mean, they know it's a necessary evil.
It does feel like that, doesn't it?
I've got to do it. I've got to have my life face on it, and I've got to better write myself about something. Oh, and I won't put that job that I had where I wasn't very good. You know, I'll leave that one out on my little CV thing and all that stuff. But it actually can be used and can be leveraged really successfully in terms of new business, but also helping you to create a profile around yourself.
It can, yeah, that's a great, great point. So, I mean, the other thing that's really interesting is Google loves it. So if you actually type in someone's name, often, or a business, often their LinkedIn profile come up maybe third or fourth down when you Google it. And that's purely because of you can't really post anything too racy inside of LinkedIn. So unless your headshot is particularly
daring. What do you mean by racy? Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Then it's pretty much loved by Google because you can't really do anything naughty, really, unless, your logo's a bit...
That's what the rest of the internet's for, I think.
Exactly,
So in terms of that, you mean that you know, Google will pick up if you're trying to... I mean, they're really trying to sort of prioritise natural search, aren't they? So that people can't, you know, leverage it in a particular way and try and bend the system, you know, and beat the rules. And they're constantly changing the rules so that you can't beat them.
Indeed.
So what you're saying perhaps is that LinkedIn is actually difficult to, you know, beat the rules anyway, and therefore that's why Google loves it.
It is in some ways. And the other thing is that you can actually, is really there to create business. It's not used for anything else. It's like a business to business, or, you know, to engage with people or to reach out and contact those people. So it's a very good tool for that. I think the thing that's kind of the backlash is the whole thing of, oh, I'm now connected to you. Can I now sell you something?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, you just
doesn't
don't
sound very social, does it?
It isn't particularly social. And you wouldn't do it in real life. Why would you do it in real life? You would walk up to someone in the street and just say, oh, hello, I do this. Now do you want to buy that?
Give me money.
Yeah. And you wouldn't do it face to face. So why would you do it virtually? It just seems a bit strange.
But how about, are these connections important? And also how, I've got employees. Should I make my employees go on there as part of I suppose, my terms and conditions of the people who work for me? You know, should I do that?
It wouldn't be a bad thing. Certainly the more kind of in a recognised area that Google likes, it's not a bad thing to have your employees on there and in the best possible light. And if everything is standardised and you have a social media policy in place so that you don't say anything rude, derogatory, et cetera, et cetera, or racist, whatever it may be, I don't see it being a bad thing. And I think it only be a good thing to connect with others within your industry.
It also raises the profile of the organisation because that's a lot of the way it's structured, isn't it? So you're an individual, but you can be a member of groups and organisations and all sorts of other things as well.
Completely, yeah. I think it's a very good thing, but I think it does get a bit of a backlash with people doing that whole, I'm now connected to you, what can I get out of you?
Yeah, well, that's just silly in real life and it's silly in LinkedIn.
It is, completely.
It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Yeah. And what about the thing about writing articles? That there is a facility on there, isn't there, to write articles and blogs and things. Mm-hmm. Is that a good idea? Does that help you?
Definitely a really very good place.
Is it called the LinkedIn Pulse? Is that something I've been reading about recently? Yeah. Mm. Interesting.
It's a very good place to do stuff. Because again, it's got so many people that are actually in the business of connecting with each other and trying to further their business through connections. So I don't think it's a bad thing to do at all. Certainly if it's well written, you know, the internet and social media has allowed people who can't really write to possibly post things
or
in
spell,
their comments.
Or spell,
yeah.
Or that's a, that's be a, any good at grammar.
Or any good at grammar, indeed.
Yeah, there's spell check, but there's not grammar check always.
No.
Yeah.
So, yes, it is a very good thing to do, certainly, in a business setting. As long as it's, again, like any of these things, if it's seen as selling all the time, then it doesn't. If it's something of worth and something that can help people, then I think that's a good starting point to do it from, not from the point of view of what can I get out of this by posting a post about how great my company is or me as an individual.
It's got to be genuine news or genuine information.
Indeed, yeah.
Ollie, with Great British Chefs, I mean, you have a huge reach in terms of engagement. Can you just give us a few figures in terms of Great British Chefs?
Yeah, I mean, we use social much more from a consumer outreach perspective rather than the business-to-business perspective. So we've got a couple of 100,000 followers on Facebook, about 80,000 followers on Twitter, 600,000 on Pinterest, about 25,000 or so on Instagram. So we use these basically as amplification tools to essentially reach and talk to a foodie audience. And I think, you know, it's a very important way of basically tapping into that community.
Mm-hmm. And do you use LinkedIn at all?
We use LinkedIn from a business perspective, probably not as in a sophisticated way as we probably should.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, it's interesting. I don't accept friendship requests from anyone I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm amazed by how many come through.
Yeah.
And I keep the people I am friends with or LinkedIn with completely private.
Yeah, so that's a really good thing.
Which is,
really
you know, my sort of, I mean, I think the privacy settings on it and stuff is as important. But I certainly think it's a good window into the world of a business. And I think, we don't dedicate a lot of time to it, in all honesty.
Mm. I think what you should be doing, shouldn't you, Chris, really, is if you're going to be on LinkedIn, find out about it first, or get somebody like you who says, do you know that there are these settings, there's this, there's that, the other. You also need to know that when you go and look at somebody else's, they know that you've been on there. So, don't stalk somebody, you know, because they will find out. Unless you've got all these certain things going on, so it's like anything, really. Don't just post stuff up, actually find out about it and really understand it.
It is. And what Ollie just said, it's a very, very interesting point. I'm a similar thing. I get so many people asking, oh, can I connect with you? And you're like, well, I don't even know who you are. And they just send the standard, I would like to connect with you.
I think pre-filled message, isn't it? That when you open up that invite box, you don't even bother to write something to the person you want to, you know, get money from. You just click the send thing and it's got that pre-filled thing. It's
almost the, you know, congratulations, you've discovered the internet. Well done, here's a button, click and away you go, which just doesn't really work.
I actually met Chris years ago when he was doing one of the LinkedIn lectures for a business I previously worked for. And it was instrumental, really. It really helped me develop my profile. And I think especially in the drinks industry, it's so important to you know, a food and beverage director or a key kind of bar manager who are really pushing, perhaps, you know, from my side of it, craft beer. They're really into artisanal drinks and they'll move from one site to another. So it's really important for Hiver as a small business. It helps us track sort of our ambassadors, if you like, in the industry and keep in touch with them without it being too salesy.
Do you know
what
I use it for
admin?
The most? I'm afraid to admit this. It's when I go for a meeting, I haven't got a clue what the person looks like, and we're supposed to meet at, I don't know, King's Cross or in some coffee shop, and I'm thinking, oh, this is really embarrassing. I don't know, like, there's 50 people in there. Why not? I'll go on LinkedIn and see what they look like, and that's how I use it.
That's a very good point.
And you then add 10 years to their photo. And so I'm looking for a person who would have looked like
yours,
that 10
yours,
years ago.
Your photo didn't look like the photo I was expecting, Molly, by the way, just to add to
that. I don't have a beard.
That's an interesting point, though, isn't it, to do that? Because it's the other thing you often people do if they're going to a place they don't recognise, they Google it. So they Google the outside of a building so they know roughly what the street looks like.
Yes,
so me personally, I'll do that as well. So you look at the thing on LinkedIn, and then where's the meeting happening? And then you Google that as well.
I think the thing I use it for the most these days is researching this show. So, you know, go find out about all the lovely people we're going to chat to.
There you go. Now, Chris, can I talk about Twitter?
Okay.
Twitter. We have lots of people that we get on this show and who listen to this show who are sort of small producers, just getting their first listings maybe, you know, and just beginning to take off. Should they be going into social media, particularly Twitter, and what should they be using that for?
Wow, that's a great question. I think they should, but I think it's like anything, it's actually defining what your audience, who your audience is and what you actually want to achieve from using social. Mm. I think one of the things that's really underutilized on Twitter is Twitter lists. Mm. And Twitter lists are absolutely amazing for monitoring things and actually putting perhaps your competitors, your best customers into lists so that you can actually see them and understand more about your industry.
So explain how that works. I didn't even know that, actually.
Oh, okay. So there's two forms of lists you can have on Twitter. You can have a private list and you can have an open list, a public list, sorry. And the private list, I always, for all clients, so I should quickly mention that Hiver here, but Hiver have got one that's for their competitors so they can see. Perhaps I shouldn't say that on air. Oh, my word, what have I said? But you've got their competition, you've got a list, so they're all locked. And so only the people at who have got access to the account can see that. But you can actually monitor what your competitors are doing, what they're saying, what their promotions are, who they're talking to.
So
how
does that give you a stream? Is that what you
mean? It does.
So instead of getting all those things that I don't actually want to read,
yes,
even though I do mute quite a lot,
yes,
so that they think I'm following them, but I'm not, which I think everybody does.
Sneaky.
otherwise, it'd be 4,000.
It's all coming out now.
Yeah.
It's water.
Yeah, yeah.
It's essentially being recorded.
Yeah. So I can have a little stream of my own.
Completely.
So if I've got something like Hootsuite, I can literally have that stream, and it means that only these people on this list will come up so I can actually see what's doing. That's genius.
Exactly.
Did you know that guy?
Yeah, we use it quite a bit at Food Rush, actually. So we have some media partnerships with a couple of other kind of media organisations and stuff like that. And just so that we can see them through all the noise of everything else that's happening and, like, you know, engage with their stuff to help them, promote themselves or to do whatever it is they're doing. We have a couple of lists like that just to keep on top of stuff.
Yeah,
and I presume you can have a list for hashtags that are really
Yes, indeed.
Well.
Yeah, you can do it by hashtags. You can also do it by location, which is really kind of useful. So that if someone mentions your brand within, say, like a 5 mile, 2 mile, whatever circumference of where you're actually sat at that particular time or where you've set it up from, you can actually get, you can be alerted and you put that in a Hootsuite stream. So it's quite a useful thing. I mean, the other thing that's really cool to do is to do it for your kind of people who really support you. So your brand ambassadors. So you could actually put those into a stream so they know, because they'll get a notification that you've been put into a particular list if it's open. So they go, oh, hurrah, and they get a little bit of serotonin and they're very chirpy for the rest of the day, et cetera, et cetera. So
probably it's not on my list, but it might be for yours.
So to answer your question, I do think it is a good thing, but I think I wouldn't dive completely straight in. I'd almost try that kind of listening tool first to gauge what's happening and what people are actually talking about within your industry or your particular niche.
And is there a sort of optimum number of tweets you should be doing a day or any particular times of day that you'd recommend?
It varies from people to people. And the other thing is as well, human beings are, you know, we like things to happen at particular times, or we get into routines, or we expect to have something happen. Now, clearly, if you're very busy with your business, then clearly you're not going to have the opportunity to tweet perhaps 10, 15 times a day, which, you know, if if you wanted to, you could do that.
Certainly but, not live, anyway.
No, you know, clearly.
Sitting there next to the phone or next to the computer is can be very challenging in terms of time.
I also think one of the things that people occasionally forget is that in the social media world, it's not actually about talking at people. Mm-hmm. It's actually about engaging with the community. And the fact is, you know, if you pick a number of, say you want to do 5 tweets a day, there's nothing wrong if 4 of them are retweets, shares, etc. And I think, you know, certainly one of the ways we've built up our Twitter following over the years is, for example, we always live watch Great British Menu. We watch all the major cookery programmes. So we're always actually live and engaged and talking about stuff when other people are talking about stuff. And being present at parties gets you friends, to use an analogy. And I think that's the trick. It's not just about, you know, shouting out saying, hey, here's my new beer, here's my new beer. Because truth be told, you should really only say that a couple of times.
Yeah, true. It's a really good point, Ollie, because it's that old adage of, you know, being the person in the corner at a party, just, go and speak to Chris. He's got all this, he's doing this. So boring. It's like, I'll just have to go to the toilet. You do something, anything to get away from it. Yeah. Because the funny thing is, as you rightly point out, if you make beer and then you keep saying, we make beer, you're like, clearly, you're a beer company, so why would you not be making beer? And you just keep saying it over and over, and it doesn't engage people. And you're so right.
So are you saying sort of being like a commentator? So it's almost like being down the pub and go, oh, have you seen what Trump's done today? You know, that sort of thing. And actually commenting on what's going on that might be around a sphere of what you're doing.
Absolutely. I think if you in the social media world, you have to define your universe that you're interested in. So in our world, we're into high-end food and cooking and producers and products and the rest of it. So we're often sharing stuff, linking to stuff, just, you know, talking about stuff. It's not only about what we're creating. So if you're clear about your world and that you and your world is the interest area that your community are in, then you just keep sharing stuff. And you don't even need to be as active as commenting. It might just be a retweet. And actually that then means the person you've retweeted follows you. And that's one of the ways that you pick up, you know, your community over time.
I think, Sue, sorry, you just mentioned about the fact of timings as well. I think a lot of people kind of take themselves out of their own kind of mindset and their own kind of business, in so much as the times to tweet are the times that, you know, we all do. So it's like the first thing in the morning, you wake up, you know, we have lunch. These are the times that people are checking these kind of things, you know. 9 o'clock at night seems quite a busy kind of time, but it's those kind of things. And it's thinking about, Coronation Street goes to an ad break or something. Most people, I'll just have a quick look or whatever it may be. Yeah. It's those kind of times. It's those kind of things. So I think
I'm sick of those meerkats. I'm just going to check my Twitter.
Exactly, I'd rather look at my screen.
Cook them.
Can I also talk about tone of voice? Because when you're talking about branding, people, and if you look at Hiver Beer, we've got a lovely brand and we'll talk about that later. You've got all that and people go, right, I must get that right. I'll get the packaging done and, you know, I've got this website and it says this, that and the other. Actually, tone of voice is as much about your brand as anything else, isn't it?
So
you've got to make sure the tone of voice and what you're talking about actually matches what your product is or who you are.
Completely. I think that's a really good point. I mean, I think the one of the biggest things is, like any of this stuff, the more kind of you seem like you're actually talking to the person rather than just like generically kind of spewing stuff, and the more helpful you are and the more
approachable
it's a great word, it's that kind of thing, and actually kind of sharing things that, you know, I see that you've mentioned X, Y and Z, then, you know, you might find this interesting, etc. So I think the tone of voice is exception, and it should match
everything. So if you do live chat, for example, I mean, it is difficult if you've got a company, when you've got somebody doing live chat, somebody, you might have an agency, for example, doing your Twitter or whatever, you've still got to make sure there's this seamless connection, that it's still part of your brand. Hard to manage, isn't it?
It is. It's very hard to manage. I mean, 5-6 years ago, it was a lot of things were done, you know, by agencies, because a lot of people didn't really understand Twitter and Instagram and all these kind of different things. And it's interesting, we do more and more kind of training now with clients to get the tone of voice and to show them how to do it. Because it should be, you know, if, I don't know, Gary Lineker walks in and buys some Hiver beer or whatever, that should be a snap, it should be this, it should be that, etc. And it needs to happen there. And agencies that, you know, a couple of miles away won't know that. They might
It takes far too long.
Yeah.
And it always sounds better when it comes from, like, it's all about making it feel like real people. Mm-hmm. I mean, we forget that, you know, this whole social media thing is real people talking to real people. Mm-hmm. More often than not, people just see, this is a number of followers or a number of following or whatever. And you forget that that is a number of actual human beings who have expressed interest in something that you have to say or something that you're producing. Uh-huh. And you know, maybe it's the media, you know, through communicating through screens and stuff is difficult to get that feeling.
It is.
But, you know, I'm sure there's a lot you can do with that.
It's really interesting, guys, as well, because that point about the followers and things, you get so many people saying, oh, yes, well, I can get you like 1,000 followers. Mm. Okay, well, that's amazing.
It's just a number.
Yeah, but who are they?
Exactly.
And are they of any relevance whatsoever?
Exactly. When you say to someone, well, you know, they don't actually physically exist. Yeah, but it's still 1,000. No, they don't physically exist. They'll never engage with you, and they'll never, you know, buy anything from you because they're not human. Mm. Yeah, but it's still a number. Oh, okay,
fine, whatever.
Just give up.
An interesting one, which is you have to sort of, I think about, you know, who are the people you want to follow? Mm-hmm. You think the example of, you know, top bartenders, you know, top chefs, whatever it is. If you can identify genuine influencers who are important, I think that's great. Mm-hmm. I think people are at times obsessed by, oh, I'm being followed by some unnamed celebrity, you know, who's got 200,000 followers. The truth is, if they're not relevant to your industry, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah. It's vanity, isn't it?
It's complete vanity.
Yeah. So that's a little bit about Twitter. What about TripAdvisor? Now, you and I were just having a chat about this before we went on air. and actually, that is a social media channel, I would suggest, because if you're, you know, more and more, particularly if you're in the restaurant trade, I would say, people are actually posting what they think, so you better damn well manage it.
Yes, it's another social channel, and it's a really interesting thing because it's, I think you can use it in so many different ways, and I do think it gives an insight into perhaps your business. But if it's used in a very clever way, and I should quickly point out that in my opinion you should answer every single review, good or bad, and come back with not just sort of standard thank you very much, that was nice, or something, but actually discuss the issues that perhaps have arisen. And it's an amazing, it's an insight tool. It can be used for so many different things. And you know, you look at the people who have restaurants perhaps in the area where you are, and you can see the good reviews and the bad reviews, and perhaps have a meeting with, you know, a person and say, well, actually the restaurant, you know, 200 yards from here has been having really good for this and really bad for that. We need to, you know, look at that and do things. So.
And people do get a little bit hooked up on the fact they might get a bad review. But everybody on the planet knows you're going to get the occasional bad review. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that. I think the key is how you're going to handle it is the most important. Also, you know, you do get idiots on there. You know, you get complete idiots. And the huge majority of the population will spot somebody who's made a bad review who is just a twit.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So you shouldn't worry too much about it. It's about how you handle it.
It is, completely.
And if it's unwarranted or, you know, people do take that into account, don't they?
They do. And it's a great point because it's
if you've got six of those in a row, of course, you're in a bit of trouble. But
yes, you're clearly doing something wrong and you need to change it. But I do think it is. There are so many. And the funny thing is, when you look at a bad review, we manage it for a number of clients. When you actually look at the person that's perhaps posted a bad review, if you actually then start doing a little bit of research on that person, you then start to find that they've given other places really bad reviews. Mm-hmm. And so you start to find that they've been to the hairdresser and the hairdresser ruined their hair. And then they went to, you know, the mechanic and the mechanic.
You can reverse engineer why they had a bad day.
Yeah, exactly. And you start to, and I think you're right. I think most human beings will notice and go, actually, you know, I think
if you've got 40 amazing reviews and then you've got one bad one, you know that's probably not par for the course. Not worry about it, just make sure you handle it.
We've had that a couple of times with, you know, broadly the reviews, thankfully, have been fantastic and people are really warm to the product and brand, but there's always the odd one where, this was really refreshing, but I don't like honey, so I'm not drinking that again.
Well, while you're drinking my beer, it's made of honey.
I think you're right, though. If you just reply and say, well, thanks for trying, you know, maybe honey beer is not for you.
Obviously.
I didn't realise it was alcoholic. It's amazing. Yeah.
So just quickly before we have a break, because we're going to talk about Harry and his bug week in a tick. But Instagram... a lot of people are using that for food, aren't they?
Yeah, it's massive. It's huge. I mean,
is it just food porn?
Crikey, you've been put on the spot here.
I don't actually. It doesn't do it for me because Ollie's going to disagree profusely here, but it doesn't do it for me much.
I think it's a complicated platform in the sense that for brands, you can't do all the linking stuff that you really want to do. I think it's a very good branding tool, so to build up your tone of voice and say, these are the kind of things I'm interested in. I think particularly for founders of small food businesses, it allows them to develop a tone of voice because they can post stuff they're doing and isn't my life exciting, kind of thing, which is a nice way of doing it. But I mean, I was going to ask you the question, when if you're talking to a, let's call it a small food business, where do you think they start? So LinkedIn, let's park that because that's a business-to-business tool, but building a consumer platform, where do you start within the platforms?
Wow, I think it goes back to the previous question about, you know, what should you do if you dive in with Twitter and stuff. I think it's actually listening first, so actually starting to research your industry. So starting to look for keywords that are related or you think are related to your business and start to look at things and then start to actually create a strategy or a plan on what you actually want to achieve through using these things. So right at the beginning, not suddenly, oh, there's a rabbit falling into a swimming pool, which is quite funny, so perhaps we should put that out somewhere on Twitter or something. There's no relevance there whatsoever. It needs to be relevant and it needs to be researched around the key things of your business. So to start with, I do think it is a really listening and actually writing down, saying, well, actually, we'd really like to get into, say, John Lewis or whatever it may be, or Waitrose or Ocado or something, and actually start to think how you'd go about doing that.
Work your way backwards.
Completely. So a strategy first.
I mean, the alternative
first
is to get somebody like you in who understands the food sector, who will sit down and go through that process with you, because you're media agnostic, so to speak. You're not a Twitter fan and you're not a LinkedIn fan. You will go look at what the business needs and then say, actually, these are the mediums for you.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. I think one of the big, huge things, certainly for Instagram, I think was the original question, was the hashtags. They're just absolutely huge. And if you don't have something that doesn't use hashtags, then you're onto a bit of a losing streak. And again, the tone thing, I think Ollie mentioned about the tone, getting the tone right. You know, there's some great accounts out there that use Instagram in a really clever kind of way. But I do think the hashtags is the big thing. And there's a great free app called Hashtagify, which allows you to type in a hashtag and it'll actually show you how popular that hashtag is. So you can use that for Twitter and you can certainly use that for Instagram as well.
Ollie's loving this because every time you say something, he's written it down. I was saying, write Twitter lists.
With Instagram, we've really noticed that it seems to be a bit of a different age profile. So we see a lot more millennials on Instagram following us. Definitely. The image is just as powerful as words, I think.
It's because millennials don't get out much.
Not got much to say.
So they look I'm only joking.
So I just throw you a data stat. So we were blown away by a survey we haven't yet released, but are releasing in a couple of weeks, which actually shows that the millennial audience has basically the most commitment to food.
Really?
And actually, so there's a whole different dimension I'll come into. But actually, I think they're massively misunderstood, full stop. Yeah, but also in the food world.
I've given birth to two millennials, so I do understand exactly what you mean. So we're going to go on to for a few minutes. We've got a pre-record with Harry. Now, if anybody doesn't know about this, poor old Harry agreed in the office here in the food talk.
He was volunteered, I believe.
He was pretty forcefully volunteered. Harry's going to be eating insects all week. That is his...
Rather him than me. Although they are quite tasty.
That is his challenge. And he's come in today. He's come into our radio studio today. And he had a little Tupperware box, didn't he? Full of pasta made of cricket flour. And then he's got these rehydrated crickets that are in there. And I had a little look at it. And I was fine until you see all the wings. And I came on that. Anyway, he's got a whole week.
He's doing it for the whole week, yeah.
Whole week. All his meals, protein replaced with...
Insects.
So let's have a little listen to Harry and see what he has to say about the challenge he has ahead. So I'm in the middle of the Food Talk Radio show office, which is why you can hear stuff in the background. We're talking to people who are going to appear on the show and sorting out all our schedules and things like that. I'm with Harry. Harry, what's your job on the Food Talk show?
So every week when we have the shows, I upload them, do the write-ups, things like that. And generally anything that you see on Twitter or Facebook, that'll be me.
So we've got the Food Talk show, and in the office here, you're the youngest person in the office, I think that's right, aren't you?
Yeah.
And you get a little bit bullied. That's what I'm feeling, really. I'm in the next door office, so I don't see this very often. So you get a little bit bullied, and you've been bullied into doing something. I think it's fair to say bullied.
Yeah, I think bullying. I think that, well, there's people at the moment smirking at me and laughing. So, yeah, bullying is the right term. But no, there was one morning, it was a couple of months ago now, actually. It's been in the works for a long time. We was reading another story about insect diets, and it was put to me by Christine, who has presented before.
She's your boss. So let's put this in context. You can't really say no if it's your boss, can you?
No, not really, especially when I'm asked to put a Twitter poll on as well, whether I should do it, yes or no. And then that came out as something like 75% yes. So there was no backing out of it or wriggling out of it. Yeah. Bugs.
God, I can see why you're not on the radio and you're behind it. So everybody's been saying that you should do a week-long insect diet. Now, what exactly does that entail? Does it mean you just eat insects, or, I mean, do you just go in the garden and get them? How exactly does it work?
No, not just insects. I think when I told people at the beginning, they was expecting me to just be eating a bowl full of insects every evening, but no, that's not really what it's about. So the insect diet in general, entomophagy is what it's called, technically. It's all about just swapping any sort of meat that you would have had for insects. So be it fajitas, where you'd have, you know, chicken or beef, a roast dinner, maybe. And then things like curry, salads, pastas, anything where you would have meat, just swapping it for insects. So I've got mealworms, buffalo worms, grasshoppers and crickets are the predominant ones.
Oh, God. Okay, so let's just, so you've got a week and you're thinking, right, I've got to replace, you need some help to plan your meals. So how did you do that? Because I wouldn't know what to do, really. If somebody said, right, you've got to replace meat with, you know, insects, I really wouldn't know what to do. So how did you get help on your meal planning for the week?
Yeah, so at the beginning, it was a bit of a, what do we do? So I sort of scoured Twitter for companies that are doing the insect diet. And while there are quite a few that have started recently, there aren't that many in general. But I found one company in particular called Jiminy's. They're based in France and the UK, so you can buy from either of those two countries. And they've been really helpful. They sent me through a full meal plan for the week, and also they've got a nutritionist involved so that I was sort of staying healthy and on a balanced diet. And they literally a meal for every single day and the amount of insects that I'd need for each, and yeah, they sent me all that through well in advance and all the products, and so yeah, they've been a massive help. Jiminy's, at Jiminy's Food, and www.jiminy's.co.uk. I recommend everyone go and check them out.
So you get your meal plan, and then it says what you've got 7 days, does it? And then you say, right, this is what you have for breakfast. What do you have for breakfast?
Yeah, so it's 5 days, the working week. For breakfast, they sent me through a couple of options, but I wanted to sort of keep it as much to my normal diet as it would be. So in the mornings, I've been having porridge, but rather than having sort of golden syrup, chocolate or anything like that, I've been putting insect bars in there.
Now, I was with you on the first Monday because you and I were recording a show. And you bought a little Tupperware box. I'm going to describe it. Okay, so you came with a little Tupperware box and I was with you and you said, oh, here's my lunch. I said, well, can I have a look? And it was normal pasta, tomato-y pasta, I'm thinking, which you would make as normal. So and so you had this pasta, and in there was grasshoppers. Now, I just can't even say what I was going to do because I was beside myself. And it was full of grasshoppers, and you could see wings and heads and eyes, you know, pretty big grasshoppers. But you were told, well, first of all, Harry, you should read the instructions, because you didn't actually read the instructions, did you?
No, I didn't read the instructions. And also, one more thing before I go on to that, the actual pasta itself is made from cricket powder. So it's slightly darker than usual, it's quite brown. And that sort of boiled really weird. The water went really cloudy and it boiled over loads, and much more than normal pasta. But yeah, no, I didn't read the instructions. So you're supposed to take the wings and the feet off, and you're also not supposed to rehydrate it. So I broke all three of those rules and they all went in a sauce overnight. And the guys messaged me the next day saying, oh, by the way, definitely want to take the wings and the feet and don't rehydrate it. And I was like, oh, it can't be that bad.
So you've eaten that. I have to say it did look awful, but that's not what you're supposed to do. Did it taste okay, or did you get a couple of wings stuck in your teeth?
It tastes okay and it was very filling, but I did have to stop after a while because there was only so much wings and feet that I could get stuck in my throat without it getting a little bit demoralising, but it set me up.
I'm going to move on from that. I just can't bear that. And then for dinner, same sort of things as lunch, really. And anything that's been stand out this week that you've really enjoyed?
No, so far the best thing that I've had, and I'll repeat that on Friday for the last day, has been the cricket omelette. That was, I mean, it's fairly simple. Obviously, you just make an omelette as usual and then on the fold, put some crickets and then on top. That was actually really good. The crickets go with it really well because they're seasoned anyway. So it was barbecue and onion. And that was just like having maybe some bacon in there, crispy bacon. You couldn't really tell that you was eating insects. And obviously, if you weren't looking at it as you was eating it, you definitely wouldn't know what was in it.
Okay, well, I'll take your word for that. Now, I'm also sitting at your desk at the moment, again, hence why the noise in the background of the Food Talk radio show office. You've got a packet of buffalo worms. Now, they look like
What do they look like? I would say they look like worms. Worms. Well, they look like dehydrated worms, don't they? What do they taste like?
So the buffalo worms are similar to the mealworms. They don't have that strong a taste. I'd say they're quite similar in consistency to rice crackers, really small rice crackers, so they're quite airy when you eat them. They're not very dense at all. And today, yeah, they were my lunch. I had them with some couscous.
But in general, not too difficult, actually. You're finding it okay.
Yeah, no, not too difficult at all. I think it's the sort of thing you definitely would struggle to do it full time, but I think it's something you can slowly introduce. So with your lunches, sort of having it in a salad, which I had the other day, it was very easy, and you wouldn't really know the difference if you were just having it with croutons, because that's how they said to have it, like have the insects as croutons. So something like that is very easy to do.
Well, I think you're doing a sterling job, Harry, and good for you being bullied but actually carrying it out. And if anybody wants to check out Harry online, you just need to go onto foodtalk.co.uk and you'll get our Twitter feed and all sorts of other things, and some videos of you eating all this stuff too.
Yeah, absolutely. I was at the football last night, so that was an interesting video to do. I was going to offer some to the footballers at the end, but they'd just lost, so I don't think they would have been too happy about having a grasshopper flung in their face.
Well, thank you very much, Harry, and we'll see how you get on for the rest of the week. Well, that's Harry and his bug challenge. Rather him than me.
Sounds,
I don't know about.
Sounds delicious. Maybe I'll try it next week.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if his like skin's better. You know, he looks amazing.
Maybe
at the
he'll
end
lose
of
a bit of weight.
We could do that. He's getting a little bit podgy, in my personal
so
opinion.
Am I,
So now we're joined by the lovely Hannah Rhodes, who started off Hiver Beers, and you can find out about Hiver Beers, which is H-I-V-E-R, hiverbeers.com. Hiver is a dry, crisp and refreshing blonde beer that's been brewed with honey.
Exactly.
Please tell me how on earth you got into doing this.
Oh gosh, well, I guess the very start of it was, I'm from Hull in East Yorkshire originally, and I moved down to London just over 10 years ago, and originally with the view of joining a graduate scheme for the Foreign Office. And a friend of mine could barely afford to pay the rent, and a local amazing cocktail bar called the Hyde Bar on Bermondsey Street opened up. And this was even before Bermondsey was as hip as it is now. And they were doing free tastings on a Tuesday night. And over the course of a couple of months, we would go and, you know, really we were going because we didn't have any money.
Yeah, it's okay. That's perfectly reasonable.
That's a pretty good strategy,
and slowly but surely, this lovely introduction to the world of food and drink and the producers behind the products. One week it might be red wine from above a certain altitude in Chile. The next, maybe gin cocktails.
Where is this place?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's Bermondsey Street, the Hyde Bar. And they still do tastings along those lines. And so a few weeks in, Meantime Brewery were there, and I guess I'd spent a little bit of time in Germany previously, and at that time probably, the beers in Germany or Belgium are really nice, but don't consider myself to be much of a beer drinker, and by that I meant I wasn't really interested in fizzy cold lagers and didn't have much to say about warm, flat, real ales. And then all of a sudden was this introduction to taste, flavour, beer styles from around the world, and a small company that was growing very quickly, winning awards.
They can be hugely different beers, can't they? As I call proper beers.
Well, you can even do like a beer tasting where you know, instead of having a wine tasting or like a matched wine, you have a matched beer with food we were chatting about earlier.
Yeah.
Before we go on to the rest of your story, Ollie, you've got a real issue with the word beer.
I suppose it's just a very reductive word, and I think, I mean, so is the word wine. So you know, you could argue that all these words, you know, big broad categories are, you know, conceal the complexity within it. But I think beer has exploded so much in the last 10 years in the UK that at times we sort of think of beer and, you know, lager louts, and that's kind of where it's placed. But it has evolved.
Are you looking at Guy when you said that?
No, I'm looking at you.
Actually, that's probably more relevant.
But, you know, you sort of look at the big beer brands, the big beer sponsorships. I mean, they're all about kind of football and, you know, all that kind
lads.
Of and
then a bit laddie. Yeah.
And I think there is, you know, there isn't sort of that heritage necessarily. It is emerging. That's what's exciting, I think.
Definitely.
We've certainly lost a bit of our beer culture along the way, I think, for a few reasons.
I think we're regaining it, though.
We are. It's coming
I think
back,
there is craft beer is huge, and it used to be. It used to be one of, you know, our greatest, you know, sort of indigenous, you know, and also exporting. And then I think because lager took hold, and I don't think we're particularly good at making lager, we sort of got lost our way. But there are so many lovely breweries now. So it's
you know, it's really quite exciting.
Yeah, things have changed very quickly. Mm.
So why did you concentrate on a blonde beer, and what is that?
Well, so the blonde was the first, and it's still the flagship, I guess. So Harvard started 3.5 years ago, and that was when the blonde launched. It was September that year. And I guess I'm a big fan of Belgian blonde beers. Mm. And actually, as a beer style, it's a little bit more complex compared to, for example, a traditional lager, maybe, or what we perceive to be as a lager. And actually, there are hundreds of styles that fall within the lager category. So beer being the general term, it being split by type of yeast, so ale or lager, depending on how warm that sugar is being fermented. And so blonde beers, Belgian blondes for me, it's not just malted barley. There's some wheat in there, which gives it some texture, some more of a grainy kind of feel, lovely mouth feel. So there's just a bit more to it.
I'm getting thirsty.
Yes, it's quite hot. You're going to let us try this. So you've got a blonde beer, it's your favourite. What's the connection with honey?
Well, honey beer as a style is very traditional. So hops.
Isn't it mead that they used to create from honey based?
Quite sweet though.
So mead it can be actually very dry or very sweet, okay. Depending on how long it's left for. It is essentially a honey wine. Mm. So it's honey water yeast, whereas for honey beer, it's cereal, honey water yeast, and as a modern interpretation, we're using hops as well. Mm. So honey would have been used prior to hops being introduced to brewing in the UK, which was about the 1400s.
So while you're opening that, I've got here that you use a mixture of rural and urban beekeeping to get your honey. So that means you've got a bit of towny bees and a bit of country bees. That's am I reading between the lines there?
There's also a range of different types of honeys involved as well,
yeah.
I believe.
And yeah. I mean, it says here that, you know, when you get these hives that are on top of roofs in London, all that sort of stuff, it's saying here that that has a particularly great array of flora for the bees because people are planting a range of stuff. It's not natural, so they're putting in loads and loads of varieties of things.
Exactly.
Does that really affect the honey?
It really does. So there's a lovely fact that bees forage in a 3-mile radius to the beehive. Mm. So if you're working with an independent beekeeper and you're talking to them about, okay, your honey from this hive, what have been the forage sources? And they're able to trace it back. So in London or in many urban areas, the Victorians planted lime and acacia trees down all of the streets as part of their town and country planning. And in among kind of a mix of maybe herbs from people's window boxes or allotments or something like that. The lime and the acacia tree are really important sources of forage. The bee is gathering nectar from those trees in the city, and it has a huge impact on the flavour and therefore the variety of that honey. Mm. So London honey has this lovely citrus note to it, which obviously depending exactly where in London it's from, it might vary, but a lovely citrus note to it, which for me was very unique and very different to other honeys that we were trying. So at the trial brew process, originally was using just urban London honey, and the flavour of the beer was there. We were really getting to grips with the recipe. It was great fun. The aftertaste was there, but the nose really wasn't. And so really in one of the final brews, I rang a beekeeper called David Stott, who said, oh, come on, Hannah, you're from Yorkshire originally, you should know. Why don't you use some Yorkshire heather honey? It's the most aromatic of all the honeys, which I'm sure a couple of beekeepers out there will kind of rally against that.
Yeah.
But then the penny kind of dropped. You know, if you're brewing a pill or an IPA, you would use a number of different honeys for flavour properties. Sorry. So actually, yeah, different honeys.
Well, I'm going to get the boys in the studio to have a little taste of this beer while we're talking. But just explain to me while they're doing that. So you got you and your mate, and you're a bit poor, and you've got proper jobs, and you're going down this place in Bermondsey in London, getting free booze and as much as food and drink that you can for nothing. And from that, you then suddenly thought, I'm going to go and make beer. So and also I like bees. So how did that?
Well, I guess I then, at that time, I just sort of was keen to get involved in food and drink and learn a little bit more about beer. And I had an amazing time at the brewery, and I guess because it was a small growing company, I was given lots of opportunity. So got heavily involved in recipe development with the brewing team. So I'm not a trained brewer, but hopefully know enough about it to put a good recipe together. I guess over the years, launched a few beer styles for them. And then developed an interest in sustainable brewing, sustainable produce.
And then you thought, I'm going to do my own thing. Then I've got complete control. Is that right?
Well, I guess you work for a small company long enough and it's really it's incredibly hard work, but it's really rewarding in that the effort you put in, you really see it grow, or you have that engagement with consumers, whether it be face-to-face or you know, a rate of sales going really well in that stockist, or how amazing the Dorchester is now stocking Hiver, we can't believe it, you know.
Well, I'm just smelling this beer now, which is a nice
incredible.
Drink.
The honey on the nose. I haven't actually tasted it yet, but funny the honey enough, on the nose is amazing.
You actually, when you smell it, you can smell a whiff of beer, and all of a sudden you
and then you get the sweetness.
Smell this lovely honey smell. Can you smell that, Ollie?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's for me the smell of sort of buttery honey toast is what you smell. You just get that kind of.
So you've definitely got the smell.
So it's really going to appeal to children. Sorry. It brings, but you know, that smell for me is a very childhood memory.
Yeah, it is. And then tasting it, it's not as.
It's not very.
It's not as bitter, you know, and like a old fashioned bitter beer. It is a little bit, dare I say, between bitter and lager.
Hopefully, there's a nice balance there.
Because
so.
It's not very bubbly either.
No, so naturally, so it's a 6-week brewing process. You know, we're not overly carbonating or anything at the end, so hopefully what you get is a lovely, natural, easy-drinking product. We do now do a couple of other beer styles as well, so there's a brown ale that does have a bit more character in terms of hop character and roastiness from the malts, and we've just launched an IPA as a seasonal. But with the blonde, I think hopefully it's a good introduction to honey beer as a style. And that idea that actually a proper honey beer, if you're brewing and fermenting with that gorgeous natural sugar, then you get the depth of flavour from it, but you get a nice, beery, dry finish.
I don't know a lot about the honey beer category. Is it a big... Is it big in the UK?
No, but hopefully we're making it a bit bigger.
So if I walk into a good pub with a good range of craft beers, are they likely to have a honey beer?
It's Honeydew is the leading brand.
Absolutely.
But is that more of an ale, isn't it, the Honeydew?
I believe they do use an ale yeast, for the Honeydew, and it does tend to be that you can get a keg and cask and bottle. Fuller's really paved the way.
Well, that's different, actually, I would say.
We've been winning a lot of awards, gives me great kind of encouragement and hopefully a bit of credibility as well. But I think, you know, what was attractive to me about the style was the history of it, the fact that it would be really fun to brew with an additional raw sugar. How would those ingredients kind of work together? And then you've got something that's a very credible beer style, but completely different flavour profile. And I love hoppy beers. I drink them often enough. I brewed, had access to brewing them. But this isn't about hops. It's about something else. And actually, because of an interest in sustainability and local produce, all of those things, I was able to put all of it into Hiver. So there was sort of, quite a personal journey.
You were telling me off for this, but I mean, there aren't that many women in beer, brewing beer. I mean, come on, let's be fair. And actually now, at last, hurrah, more and more women are drinking beer though. And therefore, it's really nice to have somebody who's female making beer and actually, you know, recognising that audience, that they might have slightly different, you know, taste profile, different needs. I'm hugely generalising, of course.
Sure.
But it's good then, because the category is just so much wider, isn't it? And there's so many different tastes that you can take into account.
I think this is what's fantastic about the growth of craft beer as an industry. In that 5 years ago, you could go into a bar, and if you're lucky, maybe you'd find 3 or 4 different beer styles. Now you can go into a pub, bar, restaurant, and you might be looking at between 5 and 20 different beer styles. And especially as the craft brewing scene in the UK is still quite immature, so we've got a long way to go even to catch up to the States. They're much further ahead than us. As the scene matures, the number of beer styles will increase. We'll move more away from hoppy, bitter beer styles to something that's more balanced. And then you've got a real plethora of choice for people. And so if you're new to beer and actually you've tried something that's a triple hopped IPA and that's not for you, I think it's a bit like if you're encouraging somebody to try a good quality beer, a bit like feeding a kid an olive for the first time. They're never going to like it. Don't give them the triple hopped IPA, you know.
Exactly. Please. Give kids olives, that's the one thing they like, salty.
Yeah. So Ollie, have you got some stats in terms of beer?
What's interesting is that if you look at the foodie world, so we do a lot of research with foodies, and 35% of them are saying that they're serving beer in entertainment situations over dinner. And I think what's interesting is that if you look at the trends in the sort of home dining world, A, it is becoming more sophisticated, so people are cooking more complex dishes, but they're also cooking in a more relaxed way, which aligns, I think, with the sort of this change in styles in food. And I think, therefore, beer does suit quite nicely. And you, I think if you see the growth in Proseccos and rosés, I actually think that beer has a real role here. And I think what's interesting in some ways is I do think this is a market that's really ripe for kind of, you know, changing and inspiring more and more people to drink beers.
And the problem, I mean, you have to learn, though, don't you? So for wine, as you learn, you sort of think, right, I'm cooking this, and actually this type of wine will go nicely with that. And I think what I don't know enough about is I don't know enough about beer. So that if I am, you know, let's say having a barbecue in the garden, don't I actually start drinking probably wine at midday? It's probably a bit of a disaster. So let's make it a bit lighter. I need to learn more about what beers would go well with particular foods. But as you're saying, more and more people are doing that.
Yeah, though. I mean, I'm just going to pull out stats. It's part of my game. I mean, so apparently 73% of people do try and pair drinks with the food they're serving. And I think the complication around that is that I think pairing, again, is this kind of complicated world. But I think really what you're saying is, you know, do you want a big drink? Do you want a light drink? Do you want something that's cold? Do you want something that's, you know, that's more punchy? And I think that's, I think you are seeing, you know, more people serving cocktails at home, being more confident in that. They're trying more after dinner drinks. They're just trying things. They're enjoying it. And I don't think beer has to be scary. I think you've got to make the leap out of the big supermarket brands and then try the more niche brands, because they do have stronger, you know, flavour profiles, and that's what makes them interesting.
I think what's interesting as well, certainly with I work with a number of wine independent wine merchants, and the thing is, still people are still really intimidated from going into a wine shop in case they get it wrong, because if often, you know, it's sort of French or whatever it is, and they don't want to pronounce it wrong, or they don't know what to have, they don't understand the grapes. And I think in some ways beer's got a kind of advantage because it's kind of like the British way.
But supermarkets,
but it's also cheaper as well.
Supermarkets and off-licences drive me nuts, because what they do is every time without fail, they have all the shelves by country. Mm-hmm. What is the point of that? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's if you think about it, it's absolutely ridiculous. So you have this is all the Chilean. No, can we have like all the Sauvignon Blancs over here? Don't matter what country they're from. Can we have all the Viogneros? Can we have all the, you know, whatever? Or, you know, have the wine stacked by taste profile. Why do they keep putting them in country profile? Because it makes it really difficult to find what you want.
It does. And I think
Go, do you know what? I think I'm going to have South African wine tonight. I'm cooking steak and I'm doing, you know, what shall I?
But the other thing is, I think so often happens with the supermarkets, they all seem to have a different way of saying what if it's dry or if it's not, a 5 and a 4 and there's like 3 grapes on it or whatever in the box. And so there's no kind of thing.
It doesn't help. That's what makes it intimidating.
And I still think there is that element of, whereas when you go to, I think I've mentioned Coronation Street again, but even in Coronation Street they have a box behind the wine, a bit behind the bar, where you actually press a button to get the wine out, which is some kind of hock or something.
Whereas, you know, it's what, from the 1970s?
Exactly, yeah, it's stuck into 1972.
God, do watch Corrie, don't you?
Yeah, occasionally.
I've been out of my depth.
But it's interesting, but, you know, the beer thing is much more the kind of British psyche, if you perhaps don't feel so intimidated by it, because it's always kind of been there.
But wouldn't it be better if there were all the blonde beers, and then there were all the honey beers, and there were all, you know, you think, right, I can make some decisions here.
The trade are getting much better at that, I think, and kind of catching up a bit with how the consumer wants to purchase, whether it be off trade or you know, in an off license or in a restaurant. And we're certainly starting to see more of a lean from buyers to a style guide. So if they're going to stock 5 beers, perhaps there'll be 4 different styles in among those 5. And that really does then offer something for everybody. And I think because of the wealth of choice from breweries and a number of beers out there now, actually you get people leading on particular styles. So they can go, right, well, we're going to have what we think is the best IPA and what we think is our local pale ale and a stout from there and hopefully a honey beer from
Ollie, are you finding, you've got all these menus on your Great British Chef's website, thousands and thousands. Are you finding that people actually want information about what they should drink with it as well, or is it just about the food?
All the stuff I've seen in that, and lots of those who compete in a similar kind of recipe space like us, have failed to sort of match that. I think part of the challenge in the wine world is what do you recommend people match with? Do you go, you should have a Pinot Noir, you should have a Chardonnay? It just doesn't help. And I think one of the difficulties in the wine world is, yes, there are a few brands in the wine world, but generally, if you walk into a good independent wine shop, you've never heard of anything in there. So you'll find things you like and you'll build a relationship with someone who's there providing the wines. But I think people are, you know, there isn't easy navigation. And that's why I think beer is interesting, is people are building brands. And if you go back, you know, I'm a Unilever brand guy, but, you know, you go back to the very beginning, what were brands for? To give people a way of knowing what they were looking for and a mark of quality. And I think that's what's interesting in the beer world, is that there are these artisanal brands emerging that stand for something. And actually, I think there is a chance that consumers will actually start to navigate with those brands and start to understand them. Because in the world of wine, that's very hard.
I mean, I've got a nice guy called Stuart McCluskey, who owns Vinorium, and he's a wine investment expert or something. I don't know, something like that.
You're buying expensive wines.
I do buy expensive wines, but what I do is I buy about 24 bottles of wine every 4 months that are my special bottles of wine.
4 weeks, did you say?
He's learnt what I like. Mm.
Yeah, that's really important.
You know, and he's so good, and he'll know. He'll go, no, you won't like that. No. And he's understanding my taste profile, what I like, and he still pushes me, you know, to try different things. And that's what you want. You want somebody on your shoulder like that. But you're never going to get that at a supermarket.
You're never going to get that at Majestic Wine. You're never going to get that in any of those places where there is no personal service. And that's why, you know, I think we're certainly seeing it amongst our audience, people going to more and more of those independent shops, because you do build the relationship. And the fact is, you are going to try a wine and it might cost you 20 quid, 10 quid, 15 quid, but actually you still might not like it. So price is not necessarily a guide that you're going to like it. And that's very complicated.
Yes, and that's what people are frightened of. Don't want to waste that money. Well, we're running out of time as usual, because there's loads of exciting things we want to talk about. you can find out all about Hannah on hiverbeers.com, which is hiverbeers.com. And there's some great stuff on her website, including videos of how the company started and the stories behind it. It's pretty good
use of about the bees themselves.
Yeah,
the
very, very good indeed. There's also like recipes, like how to make beer pancakes and things like that. Yeah. That's very good, very good, very good.
In the morning after.
Yeah, in the morning after. And so you need to go on there. What's the next stage of your world domination?
Oh, gosh. Kind of, well,
what are you thinking next?
It's busy, you know. We're very grateful that there's been such a fantastic response to the beer, and just trying to work out what is next, really. So potentially looking at crowdfunding for the summer. So we're trying to work out if that's right for us or not, to sort of aid some expansion plans. And part of that is we run the Haver Experience every weekend through April to September. So people can come and have a go at beekeeping with us, and we do a beer and food matching session after. So it's a real chance to kind of get hands-on, learn a bit more about bees and beekeeping. And I would love to kind of expand that and maybe have a sort of outlet or two and do something rurally as well.
In terms of the actual bee side of it, the honey side of it.
Yeah,
we
absolutely
need to look after our bees more, don't we?
We do, yeah. They're disappearing, unfortunately.
Don't they say that if bees go, we go?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I have written down here is it's been 45% loss of commercial honeybees since 2010, which is a hell of a lot. Mm-hmm. And they're so instrumental to, you know, the entire agricultural system.
They're pulling it over a third of the food that we eat. So.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah, it's a little fact.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Hannah. And obviously, Chris,
thank you.
Somewhat social. Do you want to just give us a shout out for your website if anybody just can't bear to navigate the social media world and needs some help, needs to get Chris in?
Or if you're antisocial.
Yes.
Yes, possibly.
Possibly, yeah. So it's just www.sumwotsocial.com.
Get a strategy, I think, if you are thinking of launching on that. Just a little shout out for the Food Talk Awards. We've done all the judging.
We've been collating, sifting, reading,
been tasting
and tasting.
It's been awful. Tasting lots of amazing stuff and drinking loads of stuff as well. It's been dreadful.
Same old, really, isn't it? We'll
come up with some winners. Yeah, we've got our awards, which is amazing, at Oxo Tower. You need to go on to foodtalkawards.com if you want to book some tickets. I think we're fast running out, actually. And that's a whole evening of tasting amazing food and
talking to amazing people.
Just celebrating people who like Hannah, for example, doing incredible things. So go and have a look at that, yeah. And you've been listening to the Food Talk Show. Thank you for joining us, Ollie. If you want to find out about Great British Chefs, you need to
just go to greatbritishchefs.com.
Just Googleize it.
Yeah. Or just Google lobster recipes or monkfish recipes. Come
on. That's fair enough.
No, I'm getting hungry.
Yes. And thank you, Guy Routledge from Food Rush, for joining us, as ever.
Always a pleasure.
Yep. And you can find out much more about the Food Talk Show on foodtalk.co.uk. That's great. And we'll see you next week.